From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I try to affect the way people think about things. I try to expand how folks will think about things, how to redefine what they think the issues are. And I also try to get people mad. You know, basically punch people in the nose sort of thing, and or pull them along as much as I can politically.
Poet and activist June Jordan died on Friday. She was the most published African American in history. On the 30th anniversary of Watergate, we'll speak with one of the great whistleblowers in U.S. history, Daniel Ellsberg. After the brutal murder of Maria Teresa Macias by her husband, her groundbreaking case challenges law enforcement's right to ignore domestic violence with impunity, and thousands march in Bolivia to protest the World Bank's attempts to delete parts of the Constitution in order to hand corporations even more influence. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. The CIA has launched a covert operation to oust Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein and has been given explicit permission by the White House to kill him if necessary. This according to anonymous officials quoted in a Sunday Washington Post expose by Bob Woodward. President Bush signed the classified order earlier this year, and the administration has already allocated tens of millions of dollars to the program. But the Director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, has told President Bush and his war cabinet that without companion military action, the CIA has only a small chance of succeeding in toppling the Iraqi leader. One source says the covert action is actually largely in preparation for a military strike so the agency can identify targets, intensify intelligence gathering on the ground, and build relations with alternative future leaders and groups if Saddam Hussein is ousted. House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt, Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, and other prominent congressional Democrats endorsed the plan on Sunday. Meanwhile, the Bush administration ordered the expulsion of a UN-based Iraqi diplomat Saturday, alleging that he spied on the U.S. As many as 1,000 delegates to Afghanistan's traditional lawyer Jirga Council walked out today. The meeting degenerated into arguments over how the country's legislature should be appointed. Some delegates were angry at the suggestion that the newly selected U.S.-backed leader Hamid Karzai would create a separate assembly which would approve cabinet posts instead of the lawyer Jirga itself. Israel's begun work on a 225-mile fence that will wall off Palestinians from Israel. Israeli officials say the fence is expected to cost over $1 million per mile and will have electric sensors that will detect any attempt to cut through it. The New York Times reported Saturday there will be new rules of engagement for the army, including guidelines on arresting or even shooting people caught crossing. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is rejecting the idea of an interim Palestinian state, an option being considered by President Bush is that he is considering. This news from India: Islamic guerrillas attacked a party of Hindu pilgrims in Kashmir, killing 3 children. It was one of several raids over the weekend that claimed a total of 21 lives after a relative lull in violence. A day after the U.S. formally abandoned the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty, Russia responded by saying it's no longer bound by the 1993 accord known as START II. That accord outlawed multiple warhead missiles, precisely the kind of missiles that the Pentagon has found impossible to shoot down with its Star Wars technology. Meanwhile, federal officials began work in Alaska on Saturday on 6 underground missile interceptors as part of the so-called National Missile Defense System. People protested at the main gate of Fort Greely and along the highway. A federal judge on Friday ordered South Carolina Governor Jim Hodges to allow federal plutonium shipments into his state. Hodges had called a state of emergency and ordered state troopers and other authorities in South Carolina's borders to block the shipment. The judge said a blockade would be illegal and create a possible terrorist target. Arthur Andersen this week begins the task of handing over some 1,600 clients to rival auditors after the accounting giant was found guilty of obstruction of justice Saturday. After 10 days of deliberations, a federal jury convicted Arthur Andersen based solely on the fact that an Andersen lawyer had ordered critical deletions from an internal memo. The case was supposed to be an easy one for the government, but the jury failed to unanimously conclude even that Arthur Andersen's destruction of thousands of documents was illegal. Hundreds of people protesting corporate influence in the U.S. Conference of Mayors in Madison, Wisconsin, rallied outside the meeting Sunday. Six people were arrested. The conference has drawn more than 200 leaders from around the country, but is also being attended by corporations that have contributed some, well, close to $1 million. Critics say those contributions give them access ordinary citizens can't afford. A leading U.S. lawyer is planning to file a class action lawsuit against Citibank and Switzerland's two biggest banks on behalf of victims of South Africa's former apartheid regime. The banks are accused of profiting from loans to the white South African government while a U.N. embargo was in force. Attorney Ed Fagan played a key role in securing compensation for Holocaust survivors from Swiss banks. He says he will begin proceedings in a New York court today. France swung to the right Sunday as voters handed a sweeping parliamentary majority to President Jacques Chirac's center-right. The racist far-right National Front of Jean-Marie Le Pen failed to win a single seat. Nearly 40% of the electorate didn't vote. That's the highest abstention rate for a general election in 43 years. And finally, Democracy Now! Co-host and New York Daily News columnist Juan Gonzalez has been elected president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. Leading an insurgent slate that was strongly opposed by the organization's entire board of directors, Juan swept into office with 58% of the vote against the board's candidate, Marilyn Garatix, an editor at the Boston Globe, during the group's annual convention in San Diego this weekend. Several other insurgents also won seats on the 16-member board. During two major speeches before nearly 1,500 Latino journalists and top media executives, Juan blasted the, quote, snail-like progress of the mass media in hiring and promoting Latino journalists and the terrible news coverage they routinely provide of Latinos. That dismal record, he said, is only one manifestation of a wider problem, how corporate media concentration has decimated the quality of journalism and is threatening American democracy. He vowed that during his 2 years term, the National Association of Hispanic Journalists will pursue policies of increased advocacy.
Somebody said, brother man gonna break a window, gonna steal a hubcap, gonna smoke a joint, brother man gonna go to jail. The man who tried to steal America is not in jail. Get caught with a nickel bag, brother man. Get caught with a nickel bag, sister lady, on your way to get your hair fixed. You'll do Big Ben, and Big Ben is time, but a man who tried to fix America will not do time. Said they're gonna slap his wrist, gonna retire him with $850,000, and America was shocked. America leads the world in shocks. Unfortunately, America does not lead the world in deciphering the cause of shock. $850,000, they said, and the people protested, so they said, all right, we'll give him $200,000. Everybody said, okay. That's better.
Pardon our analysis. We beg your pardon, Gil Scott Heron, mixed with So Long, Mr. Scruff. Here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, I'm Amy Goodman. 30 years ago today, on the morning of June 17, 1972, Washington police answered a call at the Watergate office complex and found five men burglarizing the office of the Democratic National Committee. The burglars had been hired by staff members of CREEP, that's the Committee to Re-elect the President. That was President Richard Nixon. That day was the beginning of the Watergate scandal. 2 years later, Richard Nixon resigned the presidency in disgrace. Today, on the anniversary of Watergate, we're going to talk with one of the great whistleblowers in U.S. history, Daniel Ellsberg. The same people who raided the DNC offices burglarized the offices of Dan Ellsberg's psychiatrist a year earlier. Ellsberg worked as an analyst for the Pentagon. He went public with the classified documents known as the Pentagon Papers during that time. The Pentagon Papers were a 7,000-page study of America's 30-year involvement in Indochina that led to the Vietnam War. The Pentagon commissioned report revealed a massive government cover-up. After the New York Times published the classified documents on June 13, 1971, the Nixon Justice Department responded quickly and furiously. Just after the third installment was published, the Justice Department secured a restraining order preventing further installments from being printed. Within 2 weeks, the Supreme Court ruled the government had not shown compelling evidence to justify blocking publication. Ellsberg was charged with espionage, theft, and conspiracy for leaking the papers. But the charges against him were eventually dropped by a federal judge who wrote that a pattern of, quote, gross government misconduct was so appalling that the administration's retaliatory actions offend the sense of justice. Daniel Ellsberg joins us on the line right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Glad to be here, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. So can you reflect back on this day in 1972? Your psychiatrist's offices had already been burglarized by these same men. But talk about what was known 30 years ago today.
Well, I didn't know when Watergate occurred that these same people had been involved in breaking into the office of my former psychoanalyst. That did not come out until John Dean revealed it to his prosecutors on April 13th, 1973, a year later, during my trial. And Nixon sat on that information for over 2 weeks. It should have gone right to my judge for revelation to me that this had happened. But Nixon ordered that it not be referred because he knew that that was what he'd been fearing for a couple of years now, that the word would get out somehow that men on orders from the Oval Office, from him directly through a chain of command, had led to a domestic crime. And he knew the American people would be much more upset about the constitutional aspects of a president sworn to uphold the law ordering a domestic crime than they would about his bombing a neutral country, let's say, like Cambodia, or invading a country like Laos, that they'd get much more upset about that, and that it had the seeds of impeachment for him. In fact, in the White House tapes, the word impeachment, I've been reading them, some that have just come out recently, I think the word impeachment first comes up in those tapes out of the mouth of Nixon in connection with a talk with Acting Attorney General Kleindienst, when in connection with his desire that this information not go to the judge, and he's finally facing the fact that the word about this break-in will go to the judge after 2 weeks. He considers, well, what are they going to do, impeach me? Then they'll get Agnew. How is that? But Agnew is his impeachment insurance. I've heard this on the tape, by the way. My imitation needs work. But Agnew was his impeachment insurance. He thought no one would impeach him if they'd get Agnew. But then when Agnew had to plead guilty to extortion, essentially, to bribery, and he lost Agnew, he was a little more exposed.
Can you, though, talk about this day in history 30 years ago, June 17th? Can you talk about how it came to be known by the American public about the break-in of the Watergate complex?
Well,
and who... And who the men were that were involved.
I wasn't following that at the time. It came out especially in the Washington Post. It was being followed. I was on trial, actually, in Los Angeles for revealing the Pentagon Papers, for copying the Pentagon Papers, along with Tony Russo, my co-defendant. And so I had my own problems at this point, and this third-rate burglary, as the White House called it, didn't attract much attention for me. My trial was suspended just after a jury had been picked, just around that time, because it was revealed that my lawyers had been overheard, or a lawyer had been overheard on a wiretap of a foreign embassy. And since my main lawyer, Leonard Boudin, was the American consul for both Cuba and Chile, he was a prime candidate for being overheard by the government. So it turned out later, by the way, on the tapes, that Nixon had said several times he didn't want my trial to go on before the election, and then Kissinger added to that, which it didn't because of the suspension, and then Kissinger adds to that on the tape that I've just gotten that it shouldn't go on until they've settled Vietnam, as they felt they had done in January of 73, and my trial didn't go on after that. Kissinger said, and this is quite pertinent really to why they went into the psychoanalyst's office, Kissinger was saying to Nixon, I know this man well. I think he would have other documents that he would reveal something about war crimes, war crimes. That's the way he would do it. And he said, we shouldn't try until the war is settled. And then Kissinger says, this tape has never come out, by the way. I just got it from a research assistant in Washington, copied it for me.
How did you get a hold of it? And
who made it's at the National Archives. And previously, they didn't allow you to retape these things. You had to take notes on them. But now they allow you to copy it. So I have the tape of Kissinger saying that I know he would have other documents to reveal. And if we try him, he may reveal documents that Ellsberg that I would not otherwise have revealed. He'll save them for the trial. He said, but if we do it after the war is settled, after the Paris Accords later, he says, then no one will care about war crimes. He says, and I know he'll do it because he is a despicable bastard. If I can say that on your program, it's a quote of the National Security Assistant. But the so all this was going on during this time, and I wasn't paying too much attention to Watergate. It turns out later that the heart of the problem of Watergate for Nixon was not the break-in to the Democratic headquarters. Crime as that was, they'd covered their tracks enough so that the trail of that has never led up to the Oval Office. It led up to John Mitchell, who had left being Attorney General, my Attorney General, who indicted me, to being head of CREEP, Campaign to Re-elect the President. As I heard you saying that, it's hard to believe that they really allowed that acronym to occur, what they did, CREEP. Then the trail led up to Mitchell, and Mitchell never talked. It also led to Haldeman in the White House, and Haldeman never talked. So they never, to this day, 30 years later, have been able to prove that Nixon himself knew of the break-in beforehand or had any involvement in it. Almost surely he did, but no one who knew that has ever said so. The trail that led to Nixon directly started with two men who were caught in connection with the Watergate, Hunt and Liddy, whose names were in the pockets of the burglars in the Watergate. A couple of those burglars had also worked for Hunt and Liddy in the clear-cut domestic crime of burglarizing my psychoanalyst's office 9 months earlier. Also, the same people with Hunt and Liddy, and this time another guy who'd been in my analyst's office, DiDiego, Eugenio Martinez, and Bernard Barker, all Bay of Pigs veterans, all assets for the CIA, had been involved in an effort to incapacitate me, Daniel Ellsberg, totally. Those are the words the prosecutor relayed to me. On the steps of the Capitol on May 3rd, 72, in other words, just about 6 weeks or so before they were caught in the Watergate. In other words, this order, too, had come straight from the Oval Office via Charles Colson, the counsel to the president. So here were two crimes that Hunt and Liddy could point prosecutors toward directly involving Nixon. And for that reason, Nixon's first effort when Watergate occurred was to keep Hunt and Liddy from being indicted. They hadn't been found in the Watergate. They were directing it from the Howard Johnson Hotel across the street.
This was Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy, who is now the well-known radio
commentator.
Yeah,
we have to define CREEP and everything. I guess we have to define Liddy, who's the well-known radio commentator now, but then an ex-FBI man.
Right. Didn't he call for the killing of Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms agents, talking about where they could be shot?
I don't remember that. He was an interesting guy in his way, a fan of Hitler, actually. As one of the White House people said, he's a Nazi, but he's our Nazi. And in that spirit, he had the ethos, all right, because he offered actually to stand on a street corner himself and have a drive-by shooting take care of him as a witness, which the White House, at that point, they figured they were in deep enough, so they didn't take him up on that. But for that reason, Nixon felt he could be relied on to observe the mafia code of omerta here, of silence, and wasn't worried about Liddy. But he was worried about Hunt, who had worked for the CIA and didn't have, I don't know, the movies suggest they have the same code, but Hunt had not learned that, apparently, in agent school, and was prepared to talk. And so they had to keep him quiet, not about the Watergate, because, as I say, they had nothing to tell about Nixon from the Watergate. Nixon would only lose his friends on that, like Mitchell. or perhaps Haldeman, that he himself was at risk from Hunt because of the Fielding, the Dr. Fielding break-in 9 months earlier, and because of this order to incapacitate me on the steps of the Capitol as I was giving a speech just weeks earlier. So he had to be kept quiet. Nixon suggested then that the CIA, to Haldeman and Dean, that the CIA and Ehrlichman, I'm sorry, not Dean, that the CIA tell FBI to lay off pursuing the investigation further than the men who'd actually been caught in the Watergate. In other words, he wanted them to cut it off below Hunt and Liddy. And the CIA did that, and the FBI did lay off for a couple of weeks, and then they felt they had to get back on it. So this brought Hunt into the picture because his name was found in the pockets of, I believe, Barker or Martinez or somebody in the Watergate. So the FBI came to them, and they got indicted. At this point, Hunt was now in a position to be squeezed by the prosecutor to cop a plea by revealing other crimes. He didn't do that because he was essentially paid off, and at least that was the intention of the president, clearly, to do that, and it did keep him quiet. Then, after he was convicted for the Watergate break-in, the prosecutor was bound to bring him before the grand jury again, which he did, give him immunity for other crimes, and order him to answer the question of what other crimes he knew of. At this point, when Hunt faced that, was the cancer on the presidency discussion between John Dean and Richard Nixon as taped in the Oval Office, where Dean informed him that this they were demanding more money. It might go as much as $1 million. $1 million? Yeah, you could get that. I know where you could get that, says Nixon, rather fatally. And no problem. Dean urges him in this tape, this conversation, not to continue this because more and more people will be involved in a new crime, that's obstruction of justice and perjury. More and more people will know of it. That's the cancer metaphor. And eventually someone will break a warning or not that Dean himself might tell the story, which is what he did do later.
Now the whole question 30 years later is, who is Deep Throat, the source for the Bob Woodward, Carl Bernstein series of articles in the Washington Post that really unraveled, revealed the whole Watergate scandal? Do you have thoughts on this?
Well,
it doesn't look like Dean is revealing
it. And I haven't seen anyone comment on this, is how unwilling anyone is to be identified as Deep Throat after 30 years. After all, this man deserves a, I would say, Pulitzer Prize. At least he deserves the commendation of a grateful nation, and perhaps some high office. But he really did a great service in telling the truth and enabling us to penetrate a web of lies and crimes in the administration. No one has even coyly suggested, well, I might be, or if you say so, or anything like that. The real Deep Throat clearly does not want to be known, and that raises the question of, I think it tells us, actually, why there are so few Deep Throats compared to the number we need. It's not that Watergate is the only crime waiting to be revealed and which the public needs to know. They occur daily, weekly, I would say, or certainly a number of times a year. My guess is that this person, 30 years later, feels that he has friends to lose. Probably not after 30 years, a job to lose, though that probably was true for many years. But he'll lose all of his friends, judging by my own experience. All my friends had clearances, and they couldn't afford to know me at all as soon as I did reveal the truth here. I'd become dangerous to know. And in this case, I think Deep Throat feels 30 years later, and he couldn't have been, probably wasn't too young then, that he still has a lot to lose if he tells the truth. And that's why I think we can guess, for example, that as far as I know, there's not one, won't pursue the metaphor, there's not one whistleblower among the 46,000 Catholic priests, of whom an enormous number must have known this pattern of crime, of child rape that was going on interminably. And as far as I know, I haven't seen that one of them came public with or without documents to let us know that. It was too much to lose. It went against their identity, their associations. Why did no one at Enron speak to the public? The one memo that we learned about later was written to the president, wasn't presented to the public. I want to give Colleen Rowley credit in the FBI for sending her letter revealing what it isn't quite clear, but revealing things that she thought were disastrous mistakes.
Dan Ellsberg, we just have 30 seconds.
Okay, go ahead. Well, the reason they went into my psychoanalyst's office, I will tell you, we now know, was to fear that I had further documents and that I would reveal them, that I no longer was afraid of losing all this. Documents on his Vietnam policy, and since his Vietnam policy, Nixon's Vietnam policy, was still secret, still had a ways to go, we hadn't bombed Hanoi yet, he wanted to keep me quiet by finding information he could blackmail me with, and thereby began a chain of domestic crime that did, in effect, bring him down and make it possible to end the Vietnam War.
Dan Ellsberg, and why you were going to your psychiatrist, very interesting in light of the fact that you are known as the man who published those thousands of pages of the Pentagon Papers.
Well, it was easier for me to publish documents to the public that other people had written. I was an insider. I was suited to the role of insider because I had a problem. It turned out kind of a publisher's block, not a writer's block, because I wrote for a living. But I wrote to insiders. And the idea of publishing to a general audience was something that I had difficulty doing, and that was, I'm able to reveal this now, which I didn't tell my editor at Viking Penguin until this morning, and if she should be listening, is that, because it would have panicked her, that I had a problem that needed working on, which was making a deadline to get something out in terms of publication. And since that is now done, as of this week, my book is coming out in October. I can now tell her that I would have worried her earlier that with the help of my family, I made all these deadlines and the book is coming out in October.
Well, congratulations. We may not know who Deep Throat is, but now we know why you were at the psychiatrist.
The author of Secrets is, right?
And I guess Nixon knew that as well, given that the Nixon administration had authorized and been involved with, had done the break-in of your psychiatrist.
Well, he clearly diagnosed me as being capable of putting out secrets that ought not to be kept, since I had just done that with the New York Times and I was on trial. So clearly the threat of trial was not enough to keep me quiet, and what he needed was either to blackmail me with information he could get from my psychoanalyst, which wouldn't have worked, but it was a nice try, or to incapacitate me totally, which he tried to do in May.
Daniel Ellsberg, I want to thank you for being with us, former Pentagon official who exposed the Pentagon Papers 30 years ago. His forthcoming book is called Secrets, A Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, published by Viking Press this coming October. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, why people are marching in Bolivia, and June Jordan, the great poet and activist who died this weekend. Finally, we'll look at the case of a woman who was killed by her ex-husband. Domestic terrorism. Stay with us. Tomorrow never knows. Here on Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of Bolivians are marching toward the capital to protest a series of neoliberal reforms proposed by the government. The indigenous and campesino marchers have been walking for nearly a month, beginning in the Amazon basin, snaking their way hundreds of miles up to the capital, La Paz. Their men and women, children and grandparents demanding the government abandon the constitutional reforms they say will increase inequality. The government reforms were drafted by an elite group of bureaucrats in consultation with the Inter-American Development Bank, the UN Development Program, and the World Bank. The reforms pave the way for economic deregulation by actually eliminating key parts of the Bolivian Constitution. The articles to be eliminated include respecting public lands, preserving cultural heritage, and fostering national economic independence. The marchers are expected to arrive in the capital within the next 24 hours. They intend to camp out in La Paz until the government agrees to sponsor a democratic assembly to analyze and propose its own constitutional reforms. Meanwhile, concerns growing that the Bolivian government will crack down on the protesters as they did 2 years ago during the water wars in Cochabamba, when Bechtel Corporation privatized the water industry, doubled and tripled water prices. Protests erupted throughout the city. The government responded by firing on its citizens, killing one protester and wounding hundreds more. We go now to Derek Hendry, who is the Bolivia coordinator of Amazon Watch. Can you tell us who has push through these reforms that the marchers are protesting?
Yes, thanks for having me, Amy. Well, in order to understand the origins of the march, you have to know that about a year ago, in May 2001, the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, and the United Nations Development Program financed this elite group that you refer to of nine so-called experts to develop a proposal to reform the Bolivian Constitution. And amazingly, when they finished it in about November 2001, it became leaked to the public, and it outraged indigenous and peasant groups, as well as a number of nonprofit organizations, because the reforms, as you were alluding to, would essentially weaken and eliminate regulations that do favor indigenous and peasant groups, protect the environment, and they would transfer control over natural resources like oil and gas to foreign corporations such as everybody's favorite corporation, Enron, and Shell, which have been operating in Bolivia.
What are the indigenous marchers demanding?
Well, the key demand, as you alluded to, is the formation of a democratic assembly in which indigenous groups, peasants, and really all social sectors could participate in modifying the Constitution on their own terms. And they're demanding it that this happen before the elections, which are coming up at the end of June. And another key demand that they're making is to eliminate a proposal to reform the environmental and forestry law that would favor large-scale logging companies.
You mentioned Enron. Of Enron's many political maneuvers in Washington before its fall into bankruptcy, winning the promise of federal financing of a 400-mile pipeline from Bolivia to Brazil may have had some of the most enduring consequences, that according to a piece in the Seattle Times recently. Can you talk about Enron in Bolivia?
All right. Thanks for bringing that up. This was probably one of the most egregious projects that was not very well known. It was recently published in the Washington Post in May 2000. A U.S. government agency in 1999 in June authorized a $200 million loan to Enron and Shell to build a pipeline directly through the Chiquitano Forest, which is the last most intact dry tropical forest in the world. Has about 90 species living in the forest that are listed on the CITES, Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. And just 2 days before the OPIC voted on the loan, a few conservation organizations, including Wildlife Conservation Society, Missouri Botanical Garden, and World Wildlife Fund, negotiated a $30 million conservation program to the exclusion of the state and indigenous groups. And apparently, Enron and Shell leaked this news to the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, and they approved the loan right through the middle of the forest. So it was, the conservation program was like a green stamp for the pipeline.
And OPIC was supposed to be the agency in charge of protecting the sensitive forests, such as the Chiquitano?
That's right. That's perhaps the biggest irony, is that OPIC has a statutory requirement that it cannot finance infrastructure projects like this pipeline through primary forests. And, of course, a number of conservation organizations claimed that the Chiquitano Forest was indeed a primary forest.
Finally, Derek Hendrick, the response to the Campesino indigenous protesters marching to Bolivia right now, expected to arrive in La Paz by tomorrow.
Yes, a number of groups, NGOs, are extremely concerned and fear that the government might intervene at this point because the elections are coming up so close. And so at this point, a lot of support is needed. We're calling on people to send letters to the government, as well as to the international financial institutions that really financed these controversial constitutional reforms.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Derek Hendrick, who is the Bolivia coordinator for Amazon Watch. Thanks for joining us. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to one of the most important American poets of the late 20th century, a powerful essayist, teacher, community leader, political activist, June Jordan. She died on Friday at her home in San Francisco. She'd been battling breast cancer for nearly a decade. June Jordan burst onto the literary and political scene in the late 1960s on the wings of the civil rights and anti-war movements. Poetry for her was a political act. She used it to shine a fierce light on racism, sexism, homophobia, apartheid, poverty, and U.S. foreign policy. June Jordan is the most published African-American writer in U.S. history. She wrote more than 25 major works, including 10 collections of poetry, 5 books of essays, 2 plays, a novel, 8 children's books. Author Toni Morrison once summed up her career as 40 years of tireless activism, coupled with and fueled by flawless art. Today, we are going to play several of June Jordan's poems, and later in the week we'll have discussions about her life and her work. This is June Jordan.
Most people search all of their lives for some place to belong to, as you said, but I look instead into the eyes of anyone who talks to me. I search for a face to believe and belong to, a loosening mask with a voice, ears, and a consciousness breathing through a nose I can see. Day to day, it's the only way I like to travel, noticing the colors of her cheek, the curvature of brow, and the public declarations of 2 lips. Okay, I did not say male or female. I did not say Serbian or Tutsi. I said what tilts my head into the opposite of fear or dread is anyone who talks to me. A face to claim or question, my next step away or else towards. 15 anemones dilated well beyond apologies for such an open centerpiece that soft forever begs for bees. One morning and the bird song and the dew struck honeysuckle blending invitations to dislodge my fingers tangling with my sunlit lover's hair. A face to spur or interdict my mesmerized approach or else my agonized reproach to strangulations of the soul that bring a mother to disown her children, leaving them alone to feed on bone and dust. I search a face, a loosening mask with voice, ears, and a consciousness breathing through a nose that I can see. I search a face for obstacles to genocide. I search beyond the dead and, driven by imperfect visions of the living, yes and no, I come and go back to the eyes of anyone who talks to me.
June Jordan, reading her poem to a young poet from her collection, Kissing God Goodbye. Again, June Jordan died on Friday at her home in San Francisco. She also taught writing and African-American studies at universities across the country, most recently the University of California, Berkeley. In 1991, she founded Poetry for the People, a popular undergraduate program at Berkeley that blends the study of poetry with political empowerment. We're going to play another poem of June Jordan's that she read. But first, we wanted to play an excerpt of an interview that she did with David Barsamian just weeks before September 11th. It was August 2001. She was very sick with breast cancer. David Barsamian was talking to her about the Intifada and the Middle East. This is the late June Jordan.
I think a question that we need to raise that hasn't so far anyway been dealt with is the question of moral authority. I think that I wish that folks working with the Palestinian Authority and PLO would really kind of focus on this. How do you establish moral authority in international consciousness? what would be the means to that end? And you could start with Gandhi, you could come through Dr. King and so forth. And I think there could be some useful precedent for the establishment of moral authority, which will then lead to some kind of leverage on behalf of folks who are clearly very unequal, I mean completely unequal in what's described as a conflict, but really is more like a final solution, I think, underway. Vis-a-vis the Palestinian people. And I'm wondering how that moral authority could be pursued. And I think I wish a lot of folks would begin thinking about this. I have just a few thoughts myself. I've been thinking that, for example, let's say if I were Arafat, God help me, but if I were, I think I would try to establish a deadline, set up a deadline and stick to it. For example, maybe say 5 days from today that there must be an international observation, kind of a core, at every point that I say we need one, we need such a core inside the occupied territories. And not dominated by Americans, of course, or representatives of the USA, and that failing that deadline, if that is not doesn't happen in 5 days, then I will do this, that, and the other thing. But I think he needs to. I think one thing would be really helpful is for him to set out a deadline of that sort for the introduction of really neutral, way more neutral than right now.
June Jordan, just an excerpt of an interview that we'll play more of later in the week. And we're going to end the segment with June Jordan reading from her poem, Talking Back to Miss Valentine Jones, poem number one.
Well, I wanted to braid my hair, bathe, and bedeck myself so fine, so fully aforethought for your pleasure, see. I wanted to travel and read and run around fantastic into war and peace. I wanted to surf, dive, fly, climb, conquer, and be conquered. Then I wanted to pick up the phone and find you asking me if I might possibly be alone some night so I could answer cool as the jewels I would wear on bearskin for your dig-me-daddy delectation. When are you coming over? But I had to remember to write down margarine on the list and shoe polish and a can of sliced pineapples in case of company and a quart of skim milk because Teresa's gaining weight and don't nobody groove on that much, girl. And next I had to sort for darks and lights before the laundry hit the water, which I had to kind of keep an eye on because if the big hose jumps the sink again, that Mrs. Thompson gonna come upstairs and brain me with a mop. Don't smell too nice, even though she hanging head first out the window. And I had to check on William, like to burn himself to death with fever. Boys so thin be calling all day, Mama, sing to me, Ma, am I gonna die? And me not wake enough to sit beside him longer than to wipe away the sweat or change the sheets, his shirt, and feed him orange juice before I fall out of sleep. And sweet my Jesus, ain't but one can left, and we not through the afternoon. And now you temporarily showing up with a thing you say is a poem, and you call it, Will the Real Miss Black America Stand Up? Guilty pole mouth about duty beauties of my head rag, boozed up doozies about never mind cause love is blind, well I can't use it. And the very next bodacious black man call me queen because my life ain't shit because in any case he ain't been here to share it with me. Dish for dish and do for do and dream for dream, I'm gonna scream him out my house because what I wanted was to braid my hair, bathe and bedeck myself so fully. What I wanted was your love, not pity, because what I wanted was your love.
June Jordan, reading her poem, Talking Back to Miss Valentine Jones, poem number one. She died on Friday, June 14th, 2002, at her home in San Francisco. She died of breast cancer. We'll have more on her later this week. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to look at domestic terrorism. We're going to look at domestic violence against women in the United States, and a precedent-setting lawsuit that is going to court today in California. Stay with us.
Last night I heard the screaming, loud voices behind the wall. Another sleepless night for me, it won't do no good to call the police. always come late if they come at all. And when they arrive, they say they can't interfere with domestic affairs between a man and his wife. And as they walk out the door, the tears well up in her eyes. Last night I heard the screaming, then a silence that chilled my soul. Prayed that I was dreaming when I saw the ambulance in the road. And the policeman said, I'm here to keep the peace. Will the crowd disperse? I think we all could use some sleep.
Tracy Chapman, Behind the Wall, here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Bloody confrontations, 911 calls, death threats, restraining orders, threats to kidnap and kill children. Some might think these are standard descriptions of terrorism. Well, they're all daily experiences for hundreds of thousands of women in the United States. In fact, one of the leading causes of emergency room visits for women is domestic violence. For months, 36-year-old Maria Teresa Macias begged sheriff's deputies in the rural town of Sonoma, California, for protection from her estranged husband, Avelino Macias. He'd been stalking, threatening, and beating Teresa Macias for years. For years, she'd taken out restraining orders against him. She'd made more than 20 calls to the county sheriff reporting his violence and sexual assaults. But Avelino Macias was never cited or arrested. On April 15, 1996, Avelino appeared again at the house where Maria Macias lived with her mother. Maria told her mother, "Go inside. You know what you have to do." Her mother, Sara Rubio Hernandez, dialed 911 but hung up when she heard a gunshot outside. She rushed to lock the door, but not before Avelino shot her twice in the legs. When police arrived, they found Avelino slumped across his wife's lifeless body, both of them shot through the head. 3 days after Avelino killed his wife and turned the gun on himself, the local newspaper ran an article buried on the inside pages, "Cops Wrap Up Investigation." That was intended to be the last anyone ever heard of Teresa Macias. But instead, 6 years later, her murder has become a touchstone case in the fight to end violence against women. Today is the opening day of a landmark $15 million civil rights lawsuit brought by the family of Maria Teresa Macias against then-sheriff of Sonoma County, Mark Ide. The case puts the sheriff's department on trial for what they say is law enforcement's denial of equal protection to women. Today we're going to look at a kind of domestic terrorism that's gone ignored by law enforcement for years. Nationwide, up to 40% of calls to police are related to domestic violence. 1.5 million women are raped or physically assaulted by an intimate partner in the United States. 60% of women killed in California in 1998 were murdered by a spouse, ex-boyfriend, or acquaintance. Today we look at the case of Macias with two women's rights advocates and case investigators. Democracy Now! Repeatedly called a lawyer for the county, but our calls were not returned. We're going to start with two 911 calls that Maria Teresa Macias made to police. The calls are a little hard to understand, the words. In the first, the responding deputy, Mark Lopez, refuses to take Maria Teresa's reports of restraining order violations as she is being stalked. Let's take a listen.
Sonoma County Sheriff's Department.
Speaker, female, wants to file a 166-4 report.
What's your name, by chance?
Maria Macias.
Hang on a second. Hold on 1 second, okay?
Okay.
Here?
Uh-huh.
She just left here. She just filed 2 reports with me and one with Dan Deffenbaugh. She brought some statements in. I'll talk to her. I don't know what she wants.
Well, she, the front desk dispatched her through to me. I just hung up with her.
I can't keep filing a report every time she calls. I already told her the complaint is submitted.
Last night I heard the screaming, then a silence that chilled my soul. Prayed that I was dreaming when I saw the ambulance.
Sonoma County Sheriff's Department.
Hi, somebody could speak Spanish?
No.
Okay, we tried to speak English.
Okay.
I speak English. I want to make one report because I have a restraining order. He's supposed to stay 100 yards away.
That was Maria Teresa Macias trying to speak to the Sonoma County Sheriff's Department, first asking, can somebody speak Spanish? No, okay, we'll try to speak English. I want to make a report because I have a restraining order. He's supposed to stay 100 yards away. Well, today we're going to find out about this case with two people deeply involved with it. Tanya Brannon is an investigator and advocate with Purple Berets, a grassroots group that provides help and counseling for sexual assault and domestic violence victims. And Marie DeSantis, who is an investigator and advocate with the Women's Justice Center, an advocacy group for victims of rape, domestic violence, and child abuse. How many times, again, Marie DeSantis, did Maria Teresa Macias call 911 to talk about the stalking by her ex-husband?
In the last year and a half of her life, Maria Teresa Macias went to the Sheriff's Department for help on at least 22 occasions. And out of those 22 occasions that she went to report either Avelino's stalking or terrorist threats, or breaking and entering, the Sheriff's Department only wrote two reports, and its state law requires that they write a report on every domestic violence call. So out of those over 22 occasions, Sheriff's Department only wrote two reports.
Talk about the significance of today's landmark $15 million civil rights lawsuit, Maria Teresa Macias versus Sonoma County Sheriff Mark Eide.
The case of Teresa Macias versus the Sonoma County Sheriff's Department is poised over a question of life and death importance for all women. And the question is this: can police ignore women's pleas for help with impunity, or do women victims of violence against women have a legal right to hold police accountable? And until the Macias decision, federal courts have repeatedly held that women that police have absolute discretion to choose which cases they want to handle and ignore which cases they want to handle. In other words, police have no affirmative obligation to act, and this has been the decision of Supreme Court decisions. And of course, this absolute discretion of police to choose which crimes they want to handle, combined with the very strong sexism still left in our law enforcement departments, has left women abandoned to the systematic violence against them. What happened with the case of Macias versus Mark Eide was that the family, knowing that there was a big chance this case would fail, wanted anyway, felt that the times had changed and that perhaps the courts would see that women did and should and must have a right to equal protections of the laws. And so that the family filed in 1996, filed the $15 million lawsuit against the Sheriff's Department, claiming that the Sheriff's Department had violated Teresa's 14th Amendment constitutional right to equal protection of the law, specifically discriminating against her as a woman and as a Latina and as a victim of domestic violence. And the case it was thrown out of federal court, as we expected and as has happened with most with all such previous cases. And the family appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court, hoping that the times had changed, and indeed they had. The Ninth Circuit Court in July year 2000 ruled unanimously in the most unambiguous language to date that women, victims of domestic violence, indeed do have a right to equal protections of the laws, and that police have an constitutional obligation to provide that equal protection.
Maria DeSantis, investigator and advocate with the Women's Justice Center. Tanya Brannon, also with us of Purple Berets. We tried to get the lawyer for the county on, couldn't get him, but the case Maria Teresa Macias versus Sonoma County Sheriff Mark Eide, his role, Tanya Brannon.
The sheriff's role?
Yes.
Oh. Well, as was said, the sheriff's department never, they only wrote two reports. They never made any arrests. Now, by the time of the Macias homicide, with the work that we had done over the previous 5 years, we had gotten a new domestic violence policy in the county that went even farther than state law, so that the sheriff's department was mandated to make an arrest on every domestic violence incident. There's also a whole plethora of investigative actions that need to be taken that are, again, were mandated in the policy. Despite that, that was never done. Avelino was never arrested. He was never cited, and only two police reports were ever filed.
We also heard Teresa saying, does anyone speak Spanish? What about the speaking of Spanish and having translators in the police department when people call with these frantic calls for help?
At that time, there was only one deputy in the Sonoma Valley that spoke even marginal Spanish. It certainly had been one of the focuses of our work up until then. And on every one of the 911 calls, you can hear that, does anyone speak Spanish? And then this deep sigh as she realizes she's going to have to try to make herself understood. The positive effect of that, however, one of the things that makes this lawsuit so powerful is that because there were no Spanish speakers responding to her calls, there was almost always a third party present that witnessed her contact with the sheriff's department. So whereas normally the sheriff would say, oh yeah, we did everything, we talked to her, we did everything, and you couldn't prove that he didn't, we can prove that he didn't. That he walked in, he looked at the restraining order. Every time the sheriff's department came, Teresa showed them her restraining order. And it outlined the entire history of violence, the sexual abuse of herself and her children, the threats to kill Teresa and her family. And the sheriff's department would kind of brush that aside. According to witnesses, they never took out anything to write on, never made any notes, never asked for any history of the violence, and would just walk out. So we can document that. That's part of the power of this case. But not only did Teresa report, she had friends report. She had employers. When Avelino came to her place of work and threatened her and threatened the employers, she had them report and make statements. Her friend Marty Cabello went into the sheriff's department with her not too long before the murder, and remembers beating on the deputy's desk and saying, he's going to kill her, he's going to kill her, and then her mother, he's telling everybody he is, you've got to do something. And the sheriff's department's response was, well, everybody that says that doesn't do it, and they did nothing.
And the record of police when it comes to domestic violence and their own situations, their own families?
Well, there have been three studies now around the country of domestic violence in law enforcement families. And in each of those studies, what they've found is that 40% of all police officers admit, self-report, that in the last year they have been violent with their intimate partner. So the truth is, you've got about a 50-50 chance of a batterer responding to a domestic violence call.
We are going to continue to follow this case, precedent-setting lawsuit, and it is the case of Maria Teresa Macias versus the Sonoma County Sheriff. She was killed by her ex-husband, but her case goes to trial today in Sonoma County. That does it for the program. Tanya Brannon with Purple Berets, Marie DeSantis, investigator and advocate with the Women's Justice Center. Special thanks to Noel Hanrahan, who brought this story to our attention. You want to get contact information, you can call. Rather, you can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. You can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, Michael Yeh. Anthony Salone is our engineer and music maestro. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
When they arrive, they say they can interfere with domestic affairs between a man and his wife. And as they walk out the door, the tears well up in her eyes. Last night I heard the screaming, then a silence that chilled my soul. Prayed that I was dreaming when I saw the ambulance in the road. And the policeman said, I'm here to keep the peace. Will the crowd disperse? I think we all could use some sleep. Last night I heard the screaming, loud voices being...